Other rock edicts talk about his policy to promote the Dharma. And you'll see, actually, if you could dig into these edicts a little bit, you'd find it some fascinating reading, actually, that his view of Dharma is not terribly complicated. It has to do with rather simple Buddhist values that have to do with respect for others and concern for their welfare. King Devanampriya Darshi says, I have had banyan trees planted along the roads to provide shade for beasts and people. And I have had mango groves planted. It's almost like he's the first environmentally aware king in ancient India. And I have had wells dug and rest areas built every mile, and here and there I've had watering holes made for the enjoyment of beasts and humans. Of course, previous kings as well have sought to please the people with such facilities, but I'm doing this so that people may follow the path of Dharma. So he explicitly links his concern for the welfare of the people of his kingdom with his policy to promote the Buddhist Dharma. Now, as part of this policy, King Ashoka sent missionaries out to spread the Buddha's teaching in India and elsewhere in Southeast Asia. And his actions have served as a model for righteous kings throughout the Buddhist world. What is a righteous king? It's pretty simple. We know already, really, what the elements of this policy would be. A righteous king protects and promulgates the Dharma. Important basic function. In return, this is interesting to reflect on, I think, the king is recognized, or as we sometimes say in the literature on this topic, legitimated by the religious authority of the monks. So the king supports the monastery. There's sort of a ritual way that the monks can designate this guy as somebody whom people should respect and trust. So there's an important two-way relationship. The king supports the monks in a sense support the king and make it possible for the king to develop a sense of trust and confidence and loyalty among his people. In some situations, the relationship takes a more combative aspect, and the king disciplines and reforms the Sangha to make sure that it adheres to proper discipline and doesn't interfere in the affairs of state. Ashoka himself set an example for that reformist function when he said in another of his edicts, any monk or nun who causes a schism in the Sangha will have to wear the white robes of a layperson and will no longer be able to dwell in a monastic residence. This order should be made known both to the community of monks and the community of nuns, and a copy of this edict is going to be distributed to everybody in the laity so that they'll have a chance to watch out too and make sure that these monks and nuns don't do the kind of thing that will lead to some kind of fragmentation of the Sangha. Now, we'll see this ideal of the righteous king reappearing, really, throughout the Buddhist world, not just in Southeast Asia, but also in China and Tibet and Japan. And it's an important component for us in the complex structure of Buddhist society. Now, the next figure that I want to mention to you is a 19th century king in Thailand by the name of King Mongkut, who reigned from 1851 to 1868. He is, in my view, one of the most striking examples of a righteous king in modern history. He was known in his capacity as king as King Rama IV, or as King Mongkut. He's remarkable, in my view, because he combines the role of monk and king. He served as a monk for over 25 years. Before he ascended the throne. So he came to his position as king already as a person who was deeply infused by monastic practice, as a member of the monastery. This is not common in the Buddhist world. It's quite striking that King Mongkut brought that background with him to the throne in Thailand.